Welcome to Girl Flower Podcast with Vic and Jess. We will be having conversations and inspirational chinwags with florists and growers to keep you company in your workspaces, in the car, over a cuppa, or wherever you like to listen. We hope to help you along on your own floral journey. Good morning, Jess here. So I am recording this episode without Vic again this week. Nothing to do with anything other than a timing issue. Vic is extremely busy with a wedding. We're not recording on our usual day. James had a space where he didn't have his children around as well, so it just worked out beautifully to do it now. Now, I'm chatting with James Grigg of Stem and Green Flowers, based in Hampshire. Now, James had the most amazing career in television production and has worked with some of our best known gardeners and growers, and he made the move last year during the pandemic over to growing his own flowers, and he is making a cracking job of it. Honestly, I am blown away by how well he has done. I will be listening back to this episode with a notepad and pen and basically doing everything that he is doing. I just was totally inspired by him and his practical approach to making his business work. So honestly, enjoy this episode. He was brilliant.
Well, so I did a degree in fine art. I thought I was going to be a painter or something like that. And then I sort of finished my art degree and realized life as a painter would be impoverished and impossible. So I thought, you know, what's the nearest thing? And I've always loved documentaries. I love storytelling. And so my first ever job was to go and work a TV company. And I started off as a runner making teas and coffees and then kind of stayed. And so did 15 years in TV and sort of worked up the ranks from T-boy up to a producer director. So you end up directing things and producing. A producer is someone who does all the organizing and scheduling, and the director is, you know, the creative force behind it. And, you know, I've always had my parents, my father was in the farming world. So I've always had a kind of in that environment, I've always loved the outdoors. And so as soon as I went to TV, I was naturally pulled, a magnetic force pulled me towards kind of outdoor-y programs. And so I did Country House Rescue. Did you remember that on Channel 4? It was used to go and rescue country houses with Ruth Watson, who used to be the hotel inspector.
I seem to have missed that one totally. But Country House Rescue sounds like my ideal program.
It was a huge hit on Channel 4. We used to go to country houses that, you know, big, posh, massive houses that were falling apart. And Ruth Watson, who used to be the hotel inspector on Channel 5, would come along and say, the people would say, we can't afford to keep the roof on. And she would then say, do holiday lets. And so over the program, they'd turn the barns into holiday lets. We would then fake a kind of a real customers, you know, customers coming to try it out.
Yeah.
It'd say it's marvelous. And then there we are, we've saved the day. So, it was always, you know, I was always sort of working on things where we were traipsing around the countryside, always in wellies and a clipboard kind of thing. And then I did a big thing with Monty Don. What was it called? It was like a similar thing. It was Saving Farms. It was on about 15 years ago. I can't remember the name now. It was basically, people wanting to start a kind of the good life, and Monty would come along and help them. So that was my first ever kind of farming thing on Channel 4.
I do remember watching something like that with Monty. Yeah.
And that was fun. I mean, I loved it. I used to drive around visiting all these farms and meet, you know, it was just idyllic. And then what else did I do? I just continued to work on outdoorsy gardening programs. I did a lovely series with Monty Don called Big Dreams, Small Spaces. Did you ever see that? It was always on about 8 o'clock on BBC Two. And he would go around to people's gardens and they would say what they want to do. And they've got these big ideas for a Japanese style garden. And he'd be like, but you're in kind of boggy Croydon, you know, how about do this? And I learned so much. I spent, you know, a year traveling around the country with Monty. I'd just done my garden at home and planted everything on like the north side of the garden, and suddenly he's like, put everything on the south side, and I'm like, yeah, I was frantically taking notes the whole time. But it was just, you know, you learn, he's a such a genius. You know, you learned so much from his amazing head. And then did things with Sarah Raven. I did this thing once with her where she was teaching a couple how to pick flowers and arrange them for a wedding. I mean, it was just sort of, I had, you know, very little interest in floristry at that time, but it sunk in. She was saying how the main flowers, your bride, and the filler are like the bridesmaids, and they've got a support. And, you know, it was all this stuff kind of stuck in my head. And I worked with James Wong, and he, you know, learned so much from him. And then I did a big series called The Big Allotment Challenge. Do you remember that? It was like a fake bake-off, but for growing stuff.
I remember all these names of the programs, and I'm trying to place them, and I'm sure I've watched it. And it's gone in and then like left my brain.
Oh, that was so much fun. We had like 12 couples who each got given an allotment in this amazing walled garden, and they had to grow fruit and veg and flowers. And then each week there was a round where they had to like make a chutney or something from their food. They had to present a fresh item, like you do at a kind of a show. So they have most.
What's this called again? The Great Allotment?
It was called, I think it was called the Big Allotment Challenge. Or
I'm
the Great Allotment
find
Challenge.
Find this. It was this on, sounds perfect.
It was so good. They did two series and then it never came back. But I worked on the first series as a producer and loved it. So Jonathan Mosley was the florist on that. And so each week they'd set them like a challenge. It would be like a hand-tied challenge or a, you know, a big floral display. And so they'd have, they grew all the flowers themselves, and then he would judge them on it. And it was,
I don't know why this has not taken off further. Surely we should be into like the 10th series.
That
sounds amazing.
But didn't Netflix have done a big floristry thing? Did you see that?
Yes. So they did the big flower fight, didn't they?
I love that.
And then they've done one. Oh, gosh. Now, we interviewed Simon Lysett, and that was the one that he was part of, and I can't quite remember what it's called. I'm going to look back through my notes as we talk, find out for you.
So I've always, you know, my whole TV career, I've always just tried to be around growers, around farmers, you know, always in my wellies as much as possible. And then I sort of slightly took a detour out of TV and started to work for big brands and horticultural brands and started doing some photography as well as I moved more into being a garden photographer. I was shooting gardens for kind of magazines and shooting flowers for a couple big horticultural brands, you know, the flowers you'd find on the label or a packet. There's a big brand of compost with a pretty picture on the side, and I took that picture. So again, it was always trying to be kind of around horticultural people, always in a field somewhere taking pictures or filming. But then I kind of thought, and I was always a big gardener at home, so the whole time I was in a sense kind of like rushing to get my work finished so that I could rush off to the greenhouse. And then lockdown happened and I was like, you know, all my work dried up. There was no work whatsoever. I was booked up. Chelsea was in the diary. Everything was in the diary. And then it all got cancelled in one day. So I just started gardening and, you know, really putting time into the garden, you know, and really loving, just enjoying, you know, getting my hands dirty. And I thought, hang on, this is what I should be doing, you know. So
so how big is your garden? Is have you got the space at home?
So I have got, I mean, for some people, they'd say it's a big garden. Around here, I live in, you know, rural Hampshire. So we've got a small garden compared to our neighbours. You know, our neighbours have got swimming pools and tennis courts. And, you know, they have four gardeners. And so ours is small. But we've, you know, we've got probably half an acre of garden. And so I, you know, it's quite a lot of work just to maintain a garden, and I had a veg patch and everything, but this year my garden has not been touched once. It has turned completely wild because of the farm. But so lockdown happened, and I started a new Instagram account. It was called at the time Calcifiles and Curios. It was calcifiles are plants that like chalk and were very chalky here. So I started the account. I was just every day taking a lovely picture and posting it, and suddenly I was opened up to this whole community of gardeners, flower farmers, all these amazing people I had no idea existed, and everyone was so nice and complimentary, and it was just wonderful. It was such an idyllic kind of year of 2020, you know, spent on Instagram taking pretty pictures and so on. And so, and then I think at the end of 2020, I suddenly thought, hang on, you know, I don't want to go back into TV when all this stuff is over, this pandemic is over. I want to do something different. This is sort of, you know, open my eyes to something. So I kind of, I'm trying to think about the other day, like, what happened? Was there a specific occasion that I suddenly, and I think, no, it just this sort of organic thing happened. And I think I thought about becoming a veg grower or something. And I thought, nah. And then this lightning bolt moment happened. I was like, yeah, I'm going to rent a field. I'm going to grow loads of flowers. And that was sort of this moment that happened probably about now, last year. So we're talking, this is very quick, you know, September, October, November last year, just had this lightning bolt moment. And so got some books, relatively books.
Yes.
And that was it. So
it's so amazing. I just, you know, as I said at the beginning, I think your story echoes mine in that you just have that moment. And mine, for me, and for you actually, doesn't seem that far removed from kind of the route you were on kind of already. Maybe the pandemic just sped it up a bit, because you had all that knowledge of growing and gardening. You knew you liked being outside, you know, you got the wellies.
Exactly. But do you know what? I'll tell you another thing. A couple of years ago, I had this lightning bolt moment. Do you remember when posh coffee shops became a thing, or the kind of third wave coffee shops? It's all about artisan coffee.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. 7, 8, 9 years ago, we were living in London, and I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to have a coffee shop. It's all going to be about organic, sustainable coffee. We're going to cook the most amazing food, and it's going to come from local farms, you know, a mile away. And my wife said, are you just creating this coffee shop just so that you can like hang out on farms the whole time? And I was like, probably, yes. I just want another excuse to play in wellies.
Yeah.
So, I think it was inevitable that one day I was eventually going to just make that leap.
Yeah, definitely.
But you were like a proper florist though. I mean, that's
I was. So yes, I had been from having my own shop and going then studio based, just doing weddings. I had been doing it for about 14 years, but never brave enough to kind of push it to the level where I was inundated. You know, I kept it because I was floristing alongside young children. And I think it suddenly got to this stage where the kids were older in school, and it was kind of like, right, now's my time to kind of go big. And I was like, oh, I really don't want to. I think I just want to go freelance. And so, and then I kind of almost fell out of love with it a little bit. And I was like you, going, I thought I was going to open a plastic-free refill shop. Me and my husband were speaking about it, and he was like, are you sure? Like, it's not very floral. And I was like, nope, that's what this area needs. I'll do that. And then the pandemic hit. And I was like, well, thank God we hadn't kind of secured a premises and things like that. And it was my husband, he just said, Jess, you're only ever happy when you're in the garden. He said, you are, you know, he always goes on about my dirty, muddy fingernails and that I can't wear anything nice because I'll kneel down in a flower bed. And it's those moments you realise that I'm really happy with the being cold and being wet and being damp and being covered in mud. And those are the things that's the difficult bit, isn't it? Everything else you can learn, but if you hate being outside and you hate being rained on,
totally,
growing's not for you.
exactly. And I think that's what's amazing with lockdown. Everyone had that time to just stop, pause, and really kind of redefine, you know, the point of life and really what we all enjoy. It's been good for, I mean, it's been obviously hard for a lot of people, and a lot of people have really suffered, but I think for a lot it's been a sort of a refresh. It's a reset button in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we can't ignore that. And, you know, we all say it, don't we, about how terrible it has been for some people. You know, businesses have closed, people have died, you know, there's been a lot of loss. And but then these lovely little stories of hope and people flourishing are kind of what keeps us all going, aren't they?
Completely. It's been, I mean, also it's just, you know, for the environment, we had these things where the planes stopped and dolphins returned to the canals of Venice. And, you know, it's just, it's a little sort of sign of what kind of humanity can do if we can sort of, and also the fact that we got the vaccine turned around in such a short time kind of shows what humans can do if forced to, you know, turn on a sixpence.
Yeah, absolutely. So you found some land to rent near your house.
Well, yes. So about this time last year, I'm kind of thinking, I'm going to have a go at this flower growing. But, you know, like anything, the golden rule is, isn't it? Start small, you know, don't do anything drastic. So I sort of thought, right, I'm just going to grow. I'm going to tear up the back garden and put a few extra beds in there and just start really small and just, you know, learn and practice. And then I spoke to a couple of florists locally, and they were all saying, you know, the worst thing about kind of small cell growers is they 1 week have a beautiful bucket of something, and then the florist says, wonderful, have it again the next week, and they just don't have the supply. So I thought, oh gosh, okay, you know, maybe two little flower beds in the back garden is not gonna cut the mustard. So I asked the neighbor who's got, you know, obviously all my neighbors got huge gardens. Asked the neighbor, could I borrow that paddock that you're not using? And they said, no. I asked the next house next door. He wants to turn his paddock into a vineyard. So I just kept going. I kept going down the road, and I asked, like, sort of kept going. And then eventually ended up about sort of 2 miles down the road and finally found an amazing couple who had a paddock outside their house, which had horses in it. And they were fed up of the horses and said, yes, have it. And they said, you can have the first year rent free. So that obviously was a huge help. And so I've got a field. It's about 1.6 acres. It's we're on chalk here, but actually it's down by a river bank. So it's actually really nice kind of loamy, stuff that's come off the river, and then it's flint underneath it, so it's very fast draining, really really sunny aspect, so it gets tons of sun. The only problem is it's in a slight frost pocket, so we were kind of got the first frost out of everyone in this area. But yeah, they were so kind and said, yep, yeah, you can have this field, do what you need. So I started small, and I kind of cultivated about half an acre bang in the middle of the field, so I knew that I could then expand either side. And so that was about February that I took the field on.
Done so much in that year.
I know.
It's amazing.
And it's been a mad year, but it's been incredible. I'd also like to say that I should point out that the whole pandemic thing kind of made it, we lost all our nannies, and we used to have loads of childcare, and all that kind of fell apart. So we decided, hang on, why don't I kind of look after the kids at the same time? So I've done all this kind of with a 2-year-old in tow and an 8-year-old sort of after school. So these poor girls have spent hours and hours down at the field.
That is not poor girls.
Out their mind. No. Oh, they hate it. They hate
do they?
It. I set up everything. I did a little sand pit for them down there, but they are sort of bored of it now. So, so took the field in February and started making beds. And I'd sown no kind of hardy annuals, you know, this time last year, this was not even a concept. So I started really just with, you know, spring sown annuals and started planting straight away. But I did lots of study over the winter. Mm-hmm. I did one Zoom session with the wonderful Georgia Newbury, and she just inspired me so much. And there's so much of what she said kind of I still do every day. You know, she talked a lot about, I mean, she says the golden rule for any kind of flower garden is, you know, you have 9 sections, you know, 3 beds. Oh, my camera's falling down. three sections for the spring, you know, your sort of foliage filler and your main accent flower, and then the same for the summer, the same for the autumn. And then she said, you know, by the time you get to autumn, you want fiery hot colors, you know, think about your color scheme as you go through the year. And just so much of what she, you know, little tidbits of what she said really have stuck with me and have really kind of shaped how I've grown this year. So I had an amazing session with Georgie. I then did I did the Florette 6-week workshop, which was incredible. And I've met so many other growers on that. I was umming and ahhing because it's a lot of money to do. And Millie Prowse said, do it. You know, it's going to be like absolutely change your world. And it was just so good. I've met.
Oh, see, I am desperate to do that course. And I applied for the scholarship. And of course, like a million other people didn't get it. And so next year, I'm going to put a certain amount of my monthly takings to one side and I will do it next
year.
Do
it. Yeah. Definitely. It's just incredible. Not only, so you get two things. You get this amazing manual, which has just got so much information in it. You get all these Excel spreadsheets of kind of sowing schedules, and she just gives you a ton of stuff. And then you have hundreds and hundreds of videos on how Erin does this and that. And then you have this kind of like forum. So you kind of log in and there's all these people around the world, and you can join the worldwide forum, or there's a European one. And then you meet all these other kind of UK-based growers. And we've ended up with a little kind of gang of us who are all new UK growers helping each other out, texting, DMing. And it's just a wonderful little community, and learned so much from her. So yeah, a lot of what I've done has been shaped by Florette. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'd have to say, a lot of things they do, which is very American. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been a lot of, especially the financial things, how to do pricing, all of anything she teaches on pricing is completely useless over here.
I think the Americans are happy to pay, aren't they? And they're happy to have things priced fairly. Whereas in the UK, it still is,
it's
you know.
It's a different market, But and also Erin has very cold winters over there, so she doesn't do much autumn sowing. So she's very much, you know, hits it in January with lots of lamps and heat and stuff. Whereas, you know, I think over here we've got the flexibility to sow, you know, in autumn. So there's a little bit of adapting, but I learned so much. She was a big inspiration. And then I also did a session with Cell at Forever Green.
I love Cell.
And so Cell helped me fill in all the kind of the financial aspects and how to make it profitable. And so I did a few one-on-one sessions with Cell. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be here without the wonderful Cell.
I can't sing Cell's praises highly enough.
Oh my goodness.
She's coming back onto the podcast later on in the series to do a full-on episode of sustainability, because we've spoken to her and done all the, you know, we know her story, which is brilliant, but now she's going to come and have a say and fill us all in, which is amazing.
She's incredible, and she knows she knows all the stuff. So yes, that I look forward to that. So where were we up to in the story? So that was my, and then also over the winter I spoke to loads of florists. The plan was to become, just at the beginning, I just wanted to be a wholesale grower.
So why did you make that decision to begin with?
I think that I wanted to do one thing well. And I think that the thing that I love most is growing. Mm-hmm. I've always loved flowers. I was thinking about this the other day, and I've always loved cutting a little bunch of flowers and putting them in the, I've always had kitchen table flowers for as long as I can remember. Even when I lived in London, I lived in North London, and Graham from Bloom and Burn used to do flowers in a local coffee shop, and I'd be buying his little £7.50 bunches every Saturday. You know, I've always enjoyed fresh flowers, but I've never had any desire to be a florist, or, you know, I don't dream of doing big church arches, you know. For me, it's about growing, and so I was always, I think something in TV's taught me, I'm a good collaborator. You know, in TV you have cameramen, editors, sound men, it's a big team effort, and I thought I could be just, you know, one cog in the great kind of chain. And so started off, plan A was just to be a grower, to grow really well. And so over the winter I started chatting to loads of florists, and really I think it's something that comes from TV, being a kind of a tenacious researcher. You know, I didn't want to leave any stone unturned, and I was really struck by the kind of the feedback from florists around here, that the kind of the good and bad aspects of British flowers. And one of the things that really kind of came out was the kind of the ordering system is a nightmare. There's a couple, you know, the Dutch, you can just go online at, you know, a minute to midnight, book what you want, and then it's there at 6 a.m. Whereas a lot of British growers, you kind of have to let them know a week in advance, or, you know, there's some growers which need lots of notice, so you have to pay ahead, or you kind of order something, but then they sell it to someone else. So point one was the kind of ordering, the ordering structure needed kind of coming in line with how the Dutch do it. You know, how can we make that step easier? And then the other feedback was really on quality. The sort of local florists were saying that the British stuff is just, you know, one minute it's amazing, the next minute it's all eaten by bugs, and really they want consistent quality. And and I've sort of experienced that. I've had bunches of flowers from farm shops and stuff, and it's all been a bit floppy and a bit kind of tired. And I think there's been that, you know, the feedback was that the British growers were just saying, you know, just be glad that it's British, you know, take it or leave it, you know, have it like this. And so I was really sort of struck by, I mean, obviously, look, I'm not saying that all British flower growers are bad. I think there's some incredible growers. There's some incredible people out there who grow beautiful, beautiful flowers. But I think from the florists I spoke to around here, it sort of has always had a bit of a bad reputation. And
yeah, I will second that. So from starting with using British flowers for my floristry, it's very different. When you want something as a florist, you want long stems, and you want a certain amount of uniformity, is that a word?
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas and you can go to a grower and they might pick things really short or slight, and they think maybe because you need them for events they can give them to you when they're really open and things, but we all order knowing that we're giving it time to open, and so it's very different. I think if you're buying a bunch of flowers for your kitchen table and they're British grown, you can buy a short stemmed bunch of flowers, but coming from a florist, you want maybe we're just used to top quality, aren't we?
But I think that's important, and I think it's something that Erin said on the Florette course, that in a sense, to kind of prove to people that British flowers are, you know, usable and a good option, you've actually got to go beyond expectations, you know.
Yeah.
And so I really set out to, can I grow something that is longer, straighter, stronger, you know, healthier, bigger than any Dutch bloom, and do it at the same price, or even, you know, less. And I think I think for too long, there's been this idea that, you know, if you want it local, you kind of have to pay a price of either it being more expensive or being a little bit shabby. And I think we've got to redefine that, you know, actually we can grow British flowers better than the Dutch. Yeah.
And it can be done. So one of my moments of making the switch was me and Vic were invited down to Liz at Blue Sky Flowers during one of the lockdown breaks, and she had a whole load of British flowers there, and it was just florists playing with flowers and having a chat and a cake and stuff. And it was that Bee Haven Flowers brought loads of blooms, as did Nettlewood Flowers, and I, used to what I was able to get in my area, seeing what they had bought, the stem length, the quality, the colors, the twiddly bits that we all go on about, was blown away. And I think that was one of my moments. It was just kind of like, nah, I'm doing this now,
because
that is what I want.
Exactly. And I think we're really at a cusp of a sort of a shift. You know, Brexit's probably helped, you know, it's pushed prices up. And so we're at a point now where people are actually really waking up to the benefits of British flowers. I mean, it's still a long way to go. And I don't think, you know, I think a lot of your people you've spoken to before have, you know, the big event florists are saying they just can't get hold of the flowers here. You know, just there isn't the scale yet. But I think there's a way to go, isn't there?
There is a way to go. And it would be really nice if people kind of chose British first and then filled in with the Dutch rather than the other way around. That would definitely
So that was over my winter, speaking to loads of florists and just taking loads and loads of notes. And I was like, right, okay. So the feedback is We've got to be better than the Dutch in terms of quality. We've got to have consistent, availability and supply. We've got to have the scale to mm-hmm. be able to do a wedding, and also the ordering process has to be as streamlined and as Dutch as possible. You know what I mean? And not just be difficult or not reply to emails. You know, we've got to be really, and make it as easy as the Dutch. So that was my sort of aim, really. And I kind of plan A was to grow loads. I planted a tiny amount of tulips, about 750 or something. And plan A was to grow those tulips. And then I was going to pick them and bunch them up into beautiful little bunches and take them around to local florists and with my introductory card and say, here I am, here are my flowers. And that was the plan. But that plan went out the window in about Mother's Day when a local deli, it's an amazing place called Open House Deli. It's sort of a eco-sustainable cafe/shop. They said, would I do flowers for Mother's Day? And I'm like, well, A, I haven't got any flowers, and B, I'm not a florist, but why not? Yeah. So I quickly ordered a box from James Clowance down in Cornwall, and I got some anemones and some tulips and some parvi eucalyptus, and went onto YouTube, how to make a hand tie bouquet, and literally made a kind of a mock-up bouquet, a hand tie, and photographed it kind of beautifully as a bit I knew how to do. And then she sort of did a kind of a pre-sale on these hand ties. And I think she ended up pre-selling about 50 or something.
Brilliant.
And so then I sort of ordered all these buckets of flowers in from Cornwall for, the day before Mother's Day or, the Friday, whatever it was, and was literally up to five in the morning. I was so slow. I was just, oh my goodness, it was awful. I was just, I've got an art degree. I know what looks good. I can look at something and go, that looks nice or that doesn't look nice. And I was up all night, wrapping, stamping the paper, had no idea how to wrap. I was just completely relying on YouTube the whole way, but eventually got there. Yeah. And then that sort of really started the ball rolling in terms of selling kind of directly. That wasn't the plan, but, the next week, direct customers were coming, said, oh, we saw your bouquets. Can we have one as well? And so I carried on supplying the deli every week since then. And then local people have wanting bouquets. And so we suddenly became a kind of grower florist overnight. And
so then your tulips didn't have to be given away for free.
No, they exactly. Sold. Yeah. And my anemones kicked in about a week later. So suddenly, it was a lovely bunches of Cornish grown tulips and my anemones, and it was gradually started feeding my plant with flowers in. So till in about kind of May, beginning of June, we sort of switched to 100% own grown. It became a gradual. It was 100% bought in, and then it was 90, 80, and then slowly we shifted across. So
amazing.
I mean, there's it's funny how it just completely developed like that.
And now a short message from our sponsors.
Hi there, it's Joseph Massey here, interrupting an episode of my second favourite podcast, after my own, of course, to tell you some super exciting news. Next week, from the 22nd of November, we are launching my Floral Installations online course, and I need to tell you all about it. This course is the course for you if you struggle with the fear of creating larger statement installations that can really put you and your business on the map. In the course, we're featuring hanging installations, archways, flower walls, urns, deconstructed archways, freestanding designs, and more. And we also cover a lot of the background information that you don't often get to see, such as different rigging techniques, frameworks, and best practices when creating larger floral installations. For the first week it's on sale, we have an amazing 50% discount, so do be sure to check it out at learnjosephmassey.com if it sounds like something that might be for you. I'll let you get back to your episode now. Have a good one!
There's do you know the guys who started BrewDog, the Scottish beer?
I know the beer, but I don't know the guys. Yeah.
So they're kind of like, they're slightly sort of rebellious, kind of rock star kind of characters. And they wrote a business book called like Business for Punks or something, or, you know, that's like their kind of title. And the first chapter is like, don't write a business plan. They're kind of, their first line is, by the time you've written your business plan, I will have already made, you know, my first kind of £1,000 or something. Their whole sort of concept is being about being kind of flexible and kind of just going or slightly going organically with the market. Yeah. And that's always kind of stuck with me, that I, you know, if I stuck rigidly to one thing, I might miss out on an opportunity. So I was like, okay, we're now making bouquets. That's fine. That's we'll run with that.
Have you got quicker?
I've got quicker, yes, yes. And our deli bunches, so we do these little posies for the delis. We make hardly any money on them, but you know, we make the money mainly on the flowers, not on the arranging. And so I can now do a posy bunch in a minute. You know, it's sort of, yeah. So it's become a race. Who can do the quickest posy bunch in the team? So so that was March. We started off, and then it was kind of just like this mad summer of everyone around here was just desperate for locally grown flowers. And suddenly the you know, I had all the, someone asked, oh, someone said, here we are, can I give you £800 and I want a bouquet every week for the rest of the year? And
yes.
I was like, okay, right, we're now doing subscriptions. So and then their neighbor said, oh, I hear you're doing subscription flowers, can I have subscription? So we suddenly ended up with about 20 or 30 now people who either have a weekly or fortnightly bunch.
That is brilliant. That's on my plan. I know you say don't write a plan, but that is my one plan. Yeah, now, I feel like I know, my, you know, how many flowers and things I can have. I'm going to start
it's
doing
good,
the subscription.
Because then I knew there was a set amount of money coming in every month. And then there was a couple of local B&Bs said, oh, well, I want some fresh flowers, you know, every week in our B&B. So just this nice little kind of regular supply of regular stuff. The deli and the subscription customers just gives you this baseline of, well, if I don't sell anything else, I'm going to have this every month.
But of course, you sell other things because people see and then they want more flowers. And your wholesale side must have really taken off, especially with Dutch prices kind of going through the roof with Brexit. And then now with supply and demand, you know, it's been difficult to be able to afford the Dutch. So the British really stepped up, didn't it?
Completely. It was like out of a, there was this week in June where, so a lot of my customers around here all have enormous gardens. I mean, I deliver to some of them. When you drive, I see more flowers along the driveway than I have in my whole field. I'm like, why on earth are you buying mine? You've clearly got more flowers yourself. But anyway, there's a week in June when suddenly all the local sales just dropped. It was like, clearly they were all just picking their own roses. But then suddenly, like out of the blue, all these wedding orders came in, and it was amazing kind of switch from bouquet sales to wholesale. And I was blown over by how all these wedding florists were coming out of the woodwork that I had no idea all lived, you know, within a few miles of here. And it was just mega. It was suddenly June, July, August, September was just cutting hundreds of thousands of stems or hundreds of stems every week for weddings and stuff. And it was, just couldn't keep up. And I was just saying no to half of them. It was,
I know. Yeah. I tell you what I found amazing. I don't know if you find this, that you can look at your field and you think you've cut nearly everything from it and you have a panic like, oh my God, can I fulfill this order? And then you go and you start cutting and you go, oh no, I've got a lot more. You know, once you start cutting into buckets, you realize you've got shed loads of the stuff.
Oh my goodness, it's impossible. And people just go, have you got this? And it's not, I've got no list. I can't say I've got X number of dahlias. So after a while, I kept keeping account of how many we were cutting each week. So I roughly knew what we could supply each week. But it was, and then these florists just kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And it was just, the weddings were just bonkers. And
so you said earlier about how you wanted to keep your ordering system as close and as simple to the Dutch system as possible. How does that look? What have you come up with?
So what we do is for retail customers, we have obviously a website like everyone else, and you just buy a bouquet through that. Florists, this year we did so every Sunday I would send out an email and I would list everything would be in a long list. So it would be the name of the plant, the color, in alphabetical order. So the name of the plant, the color, the stem length, the color, and then the price. And you could literally buy the stem. So it was 50p for this, 60p for that, pound for that. And there'd be photographs of almost 90% of the flowers had a photograph with them as well. And so, and then they just would email me the next day. And I would say, yes, all booked, come and pick it up. And then they would get an invoice. So that's been, but I think next year we're going to move on to an online system. So you can actually literally click and buy.
And how did you kind of keep track of how many? So if 7 florists all ordered 50 stems and you didn't have that, did it kind of already say sold out, or did you then have to go back and say, I'm really sorry that sold?
Yes. Yeah. I think I kind of over the summer I was keeping account. It's really important to sort of I wrote down everything we were cutting. And so I knew that we could cut, I can't remember what it is now, like, you know, 400-500 dahlias on a Thursday. And so suddenly I knew that we had roughly each week we'd have 300 whites and creams, and most people buy within color schemes, don't they?
Yeah.
And so I knew that I could do 2 white/pink weddings a week. And so when the third florist comes along wanting white and pink, I'd be like, I'm really sorry, you know, it's gone to the last 2. But I had a very rough idea in the back of my head.
Yeah.
And sometimes those weeks where you were really cutting it thin and you're like, oh, it's the very last one. And then other times I've said no and still tons of flowers there. So it's hard, isn't it?
And so then by moving that, by keeping your notes and moving that online now, you'll be able to kind of put your number and it'll instantly then say sold out, won't it?
Totally. Yeah. So next year, now we've got an idea of roughly how many plants, how many flowers each plant, you know, produces a week. We can sort of, I'll do a rough count every Sunday, and then Sunday night the shop will open and you can sort of buy away. But
that's amazing. Yeah,
it's just trying to, you know, I've just got to try and make it as easy as possible, because I think the, you know, florists are busy. The last thing they want to do is go back and forth with emails and that sort of thing. So trying to make the system as streamlined as possible. Also, it helps me, you know, not if they buy it straight away online, I don't have to then spend hours invoicing, you know, it's just, and then it's all done. So it's just trying to make it as simple and streamlined for everyone. Because at the end of the day, we've got to try and keep our costs down, and that helps not make the flowers too expensive. So, you know, it's win-win for everyone. So
this is brilliant. I'm taking so much advice from this. I think what you've done very sensibly is over your winter period, you did all of your groundwork, didn't you? You contacted people and you got in, you know, whereas I went into it going, no, I'm going to grow. I'm going to plant all the pretty things. And my technical side is very, very weak. So I'm going to take note, and I've written down here, sort website.
Yeah, oh, it's so key. And I think, you know, someone said to me, florists buy with their eyes. Yeah. And that's always stuck with me. You know, it's trying to be as visual as possible. You know, even just on Instagram stories, once if I've picked something, like in the summer I grew loads of basil. I'm big on herbs here. So I had these amazing different colored basils, and I just once, just the first bunch, took a nice photograph of it, bunged it on a story. Literally the next day I had like 5 or 6 orders for, pretty much cleared me out. You know, it's just amazing how just a little picture has such an effect. But
And growing the things that are slightly unique, you know, it's things like having the selection of herbs and basil, especially, you know, trying to get it into the right stem length and have that is something everyone's going to want instantly.
Oh my goodness. It's just been, that was another big feedback thing from the florist, the amount of things they can't get from Holland, you know, like Dutch dahlias just don't seem to, you know, travel well or come really small. So, okay, let's do dahlias. That's a big thing. And there's just scented pelargoniums, raspberry foliage, cress, you know, just those lovely little things that you can't really get on the auctions. So I sort of, yeah. You know, I've always, you know, there's another thing that Erin is big on at Florette, you know, it's being us, those, well, you know, we're all specialty growers. It's grow those things that aren't easy to travel, you know, those things that are best local, best fresh, but a little bit different, a little bit quirky. And that's really sort of stuck with me. I'm also, I love colour, and I think it's from my kind of painter's background. I think it's important to grow palettes of colour. So I've really sort of, you know, it's a bit like putting on an exhibition. I kind of curate my flower beds to be a certain colour scheme. And so if you buy a bucket of flowers from me, you know, I can offer you a sort of a pastel bucket or a hots and reds, you know, we're going to have stuff which is going to go together. And
yes,
I think that is so key.
It really is. And I you know, I did a textile design degree, and I feel like that kind of has stood me in really good stead going forward, because I understand color and proportion, you know, the same as you. And putting together a color palette in a bucket for a florist or for somebody, it excites me. I absolutely love it. And it's also when your daily, like this year, my dahlias came out, and two varieties are definitely not what I ordered. And with anything else. They are, you know, they might be quite nice, but to me, they're just eyesores, because in the middle of my beautiful lilac and cream bed was this red, small, short head. It was just awful, you know, just an awful insult. So yeah, it's good to be able to have that color skill.
Totally. And it's I think that's another feedback that I had from so many florists, that British growers sort of, there's been this concept that if it's seasonal, it should go together. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, it doesn't. You know, if you've got a bright red rose and something else that's, you know, even though they're growing at the same time, they don't have to go together, you know. And it's really kind of upping that level of quality and consistency, and having those colors that really match and are harmonious. So
yeah,
but it's interesting, isn't it?
With all of your growing courses and people that you have met through growing, how many of them are men?
You know what? Not many. You know, it's I've so far everyone I've named is ladies, really. But I mean, there are. I think, you know, there's that kind of traditional world of old school British growers. There's the chrysanthemum growers. You know, they're kind of the growers who grow one type.
Yeah.
You know, that's still very male orientated. You know, you've got BJ Richards down in Cornwall, and Paul and his family, and you've got James Clowance, you know, down in Cornwall. So there's a lot of these, and you've got Ben Cross down at Crosslands growing Alstromerias, you know, third generation Alstro grower. There's a lot of these kind of, you know, the men tend to be slightly more old school greenhouse, glasshouse, sort of single variety growers. But there's actually remarkably a large amount of guys growing, I think. It's they're all there, aren't they? You just have to find.
Yeah, it just does seem to be lots of women doing this, doing what I would call, what you and I do, more of an artisan grower. Yeah. You know, that we grow lots of different varieties. It definitely does seem to be more of a female career path at the moment.
I think it's because it's come out of florist, you know, flower growing for the cut flower, you know, I assumed every member of Flowers from the Farm was a kind of a wholesale grower. And it struck me that actually sort of 90% of the Flowers from the Farm members purely grow to make, you know, for their own use.
Yeah.
And so it's really, you know, our kind of British, the new wave of British growers is pretty much, it's come from people who love, you know, who love bouquets and who love arranging and have just wanted to grow their own little patches. And I think we've sort of evolved from that world. Whereas,
I wonder if we need a little subsection on there that's just wholesale, so florists can go there and just see who's on.
Definitely. It's I think someone has just made up a list, and it's actually not a very long list. It's
really? And is that list on the Flowers from the Farm, or is that a separate thing?
I think it is one of the Flowers from the Farm members has done it on their own website, and they talked about it on the Flowers from the Farm Facebook group.
But I'll look that up.
It definitely needs to be on that list. I think, you know, if you Google wholesale, you know, British growers, you kind of get, you know, Evolve and, you know, three other names come up, you know, Real Flower Company. And it's there, you can't, it's hard to find. And and I think, again, that's another reason that it's hard for florists to know where to get their flowers from, you know, or to use British, just because, you know, I had a couple of florists come to me and they said, oh, I've rung around my, I looked on Flowers from the Farm and I rung around and everyone, you know, just uses their own flowers. And, you know, it's hard to find. So I think, yeah, you're right. We did a list.
Yeah. Actually, your idea for just making it really simple and keeping it visual, if all of the people who want to supply wholesale had that on their website, you know, your Sunday night list with a picture and what you've got, and, you know, order online, deliver/collect on Wednesday or Thursday, whatever, that is going to change it completely, isn't it?
And I think we need to see more collectives as well. I know Sel kind of works with another local florist to her, and they combine their flowers. And I know there's a collective around Bristol where they kind of, and I think that we need to see more of that, where we can sort of 4 or 5 local growers combine their lists, and because you're going to offer them a far wider range of flowers, and that way we can probably hit those, you know, quantity numbers that the big event florists want. So we need someone to pull us all together.
Well, we definitely can, like, on a small patch of land, grow quantity. I realized this year very quickly that I need to buy a van, because a car boot doesn't cut it, does it?
When you're
trying to deliver, even for a small wedding, you know, you need a big van to take the flowers to them.
I mean, I'm lucky I don't do weddings. I'm not going to do weddings. But British Flower Week, we did a big kind of show at a local cafe. And I had to do like 3 carloads.
Yeah.
I was like, how do they? And then it kind of struck me. Yes, that's why florists all have vans.
Yeah.
It's all those pots and buckets and big foliage.
I know. But even just delivering it to a florist, you end up filling up, don't you? Squeezing things in and trying to look in your rearview mirror, you're going, oh, and I can see his tree.
Oh, it's a beautiful view though. I nearly crash sometimes when I'm looking at the gorgeous, but my back seats have now gone. My car is pretty much a sort of a van. It's covered in mud, and then you slam the brakes on and water splashes everywhere. So
absolutely. The amount of time I've had to make my children take a towel into the car to sit down because the seats are still damp from a spilled bucket.
But I even started in the summer, I started doing couriered flowers. So now I ship nationwide. It was a hard call to make because there's the sort of the sustainable issues with driving stuff around. You know, suddenly these flowers crack and sort of crank up a bit of an air, sort of some carbon miles. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I think I'm just really keen to make British flowers accessible and, you know, for both wholesale and retail customers, just make it really easy and affordable. And then there's sort of no excuse not to use British. So
that's even just a courier, you know, within the UK is going to be less impact on the environment than driving all the way from Holland or flying in from Ecuador. But it's interesting the point you make about Flowers from the Farm with the lack of wholesale flowers, because I had assumed that people would florists would be able to access wholesalers in their own area from flowers from the farm to get their flowers. And that's why I've kind of thought, oh no, I won't ship too far, and you know, there's no need for me to drive over here because they'll be able to find somebody else. But if there's not that there, then that's another thing for other growers to look into as well, isn't it?
Completely. I mean, I've had so many. The other day, I had a local deli, a shop, not local to me, talked to me about supplying kind of deli flowers, and they're, I mean, they're sort of 50 miles away, and I sort of said, well, surely there are growers near you, you know, have you looked on flowers from the farm? And they said, yes, we've contacted them all, and they just don't have the supply. So, you know, so that is an issue, and my number one thing is to always promote local growers. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's going to be the number one thing. But if there isn't local growers, I'm always up for helping and shipping. So
yeah, especially if you've got the quantity and the quality and everything right, then you know it's no good to you sat in the field, is it?
No, exactly. And it's you know, I just really want to make British flowers accessible. So let's you know, let's try and work out ways of getting them to you. And so at the moment, there's such a long list of things that don't travel well. So I'm sort of my head is playing on ideas of how to wrap things and how to transport things. And can we make fancy little boxes or wrap the stems in some sort of sustainable material? So I think this winter I'm going to do lots of work on how to ship things that are delicate.
I wonder how sheets would work.
I think that's it's a really good idea. I think that's used quite a lot in food, you know, shipping frozen foods and stuff.
Yeah, wrap it in plastic first, though, don't they?
Yeah, you know? I know. I'll show you this. I mean, people listening won't be able to see this, but this material here is made from recycled cotton, and it's all completely biodegradable. It's like, how would I describe this? It's like a sheet of very felty material, and this is used in the chemical industry as a soaking up pad. So they use it in factories where they do lots of spilling of oil and stuff, but so it's completely not from the florist industry, but I think this is going to be nice, perfect.
So is that a sample you're going to be trialing out then?
Yes. So this is, so it's a sort of a sheet of kind of basically sort of felty material that's made from recycled cloth, and it's completely biodegradable. It'll be completely compostable, and it's really absorbent. So we can sort of wrap everything in this, and it'll keep everything comfy, cozy, and soggy. So I'm sort of trying to really, I keep trying to think, you know, I'm not going to, you know, how can I package things differently? How can I do that? How can I find a way of doing that in a different way and keep, you know, making sure those perfect dahlias arrive to North Scotland, you know.
James, are you doing all of this on your own? Do you have help?
So I have a little unhelpful 2-year-old who helps me most of the time. I have an incredible wife who is supportive in taking the kids away at the weekend and that sort of thing, but she never steps out. She's very much an indoors person. And then I have got a little team of wonderful freelancers who come. I've got one chap who comes and mows all the paths for me once a week, and I've got two florists who come every so often. So I've been absolutely bowled over by the local support, and
all of your pictures of your plot look absolutely pristine. Your grass paths, I'm absolutely envious of. I did plastic the matting and put wood chip over the top purely because my husband said I'm not mowing it.
My goodness, it's so hard. I just it's the bane of my life, those grass paths. They, you know, it takes us 3 hours a week to mow them.
They look beautiful.
So the grass paths are just been bane of my life, but someone I think it was Erin from Florette said, you know, I think sometimes our cutting gardens need to feel like, you know, like a National Trust cutting garden. There's something in keeping them looking beautiful, you know, not only for clients who come and see the places, but, you know, for us to enjoy. And so, yeah, I've really sort of wanted to curate that field in a way that it looks attractive to that. We've actually got a footpath that goes through the field. So I keep kind of, when I'm planting stuff, I'm like, you know, how will it look from the footpath? You know, because it's a, so many people, you know, take our details down and then subsequently buy because they've walked past. So yeah, I think it's vital that, I mean, sometimes I just wish I had, it was a closed site and no one could see it and I could make a mess. But actually, yeah, keeping it looking beautiful is, it's good for the photos. It's good for the public. Yeah. It's good for us. You know, it's nice to spend time in a beautiful space. Also, I struggle with the environmental impact of using plastic. You know, we call ourselves, you know, Stem and Green, the natural flower farm, and that word natural, I kind of want to kind of go through everything we do, and, you know, we want to grow naturally, arrange in a natural way, and, you know, suddenly if we're starting using Mypex, you know, landscape fabric everywhere, it, you know, does that sort of detract from that kind of core concept of doing it in a natural way? But you know what, it's such a good weed suppressant, and you know, I've half our beds we've planted, you know, with open beds, and half our beds we've planted through landscape fabric, and it's just the amount of time saved weeding. So I think some of our paths are going to get landscape fabriced this winter. It's going to sneak in.
Yeah, I didn't. Because I put so much down for my paths, I didn't plant anything with like three plastic. And oh my God, the weeding.
I know.
It's been incredible.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, are you growing in do you do no dig, or are you a digger?
No, the new beds are no dig. When I took the field on, it had been a wheat field. So I had it completely ploughed and power harrowed. So I was able to just plant straight in.
Yeah.
But perfect. from there, I am just adding compost. And the only things I dig are my tulip bulbs going in. Yeah.
So now I've spoken to a couple of kind of no dig gardeners who've done it for a long time. And they say for the first 3 years, you know, weeds are going to keep coming up, and then there's a kind of a golden moment in no dig beds, that 3 year point, the weeds just stop. So
I'm also the trick I use in my own garden is if you plant things close enough together, no weed can grow. So in my perennial beds, because I'm trying to get them established, I have put them very close together, knowing that over the next couple of years I'll be able to thin them out and double my quantities. So in quite a lot of the perennial beds, as they got a bit more established as the year went on, there were less and less weeds. Loads of weeds.
I know. Planting through landscape fabric is just crucial to saving time, saving chemical use, saving water, because it sort of keeps, you know, any sort of burn off from the sun. So I think sadly more landscape fabric will be appearing
year. But you know, you reuse it, don't you?
Totally. It's all about, no, exactly. And every plastic that I've bought has been, you know, actually I want 5, 6, 7 years out of this. So we've got our netting is, you know, a lot of people use pea netting. That really, I've got football goal netting,
what a good idea.
I know, it's perfect. It's the perfect 12 centimeter square. And it is made from like a really thick plasticky sort of stringy stuff. You know, it's like woven.
Yeah.
And so it's really thick. Several times I've accidentally cut it with really sharp secateurs and it hasn't gone through. So, you know, it is just, it's like hard as nails. And I think,
oh my goodness, that has just changed everything for me.
10, 20 years I'm expecting from these nets. I'll be highly disappointed if they give up the ghost before that. So.
That, you know, I think
plastic is good. Plastic is not a bad word if kind of used properly and used for a long time. So
yeah, absolutely. But it's about finding a product that lasts, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. Like seed trays and seed pods. Seed trays and seed cell trays and stuff. You know, they're all good if you can get a life out of them. So
Thank you so much for speaking with me, James. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was brilliant. I think I need you to run a course to teach me how to grow better and how to run my business better, because you just seem to have it all sorted out and I love it. So yes, I will be back next week with Victoria. I hope that we don't have to do any more solo recordings. And in the meantime, as I keep on saying, our calendar is still available to order. So yeah, go follow the links on our Instagram, or go to our website and you will be able to buy yourself one or more copies, and I shall handwrite your envelope and pop them in the post for you.